Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Today's episode is a STEM skills episode. STEM skills episodes are what I used to call soft skills episodes. However, my guest today asked me to start calling them not soft skills, but critical people skills, and that's an important distinction. Today we are talking about how to handle difficult work situations such as microaggressions, aggressions, and others. Joining me to provide her expertise is Dr. Tanya Hewitt. Tanya has a PhD in population health and bachelor's and master's degrees in physics. She's the founder and CEO of Beyond Safety Compliance and brings a wealth of knowledge for this conversation. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Tanya. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm just great, Kathy.
I appreciate you being on the podcast today. And what I wanted to talk about was, when I first contacted you, it was about microaggressions. And then in doing a little bit more thinking, I'm like, it kind of goes beyond that to just dealing with, like, I think, difficult behaviors in the workplace in general, when it is, you know, I think that we all have these policies in place within our companies of, you know, how to address harassment and even microaggressions, and, well, maybe not microaggressions within companies, but, you know, how you address, like, bad behavior and stuff like that. But I think that typically that's more on the side of when it's happening within your company from a coworker or a colleague or even, you know, somebody else in another position. But I've recently moved into a role where I am a consultant. And so I'm dealing with clients. And then even at my past role, when I was at my utility, we also had not general public customers, but we were a generation transmission company. And so we had distribution cooperatives who are our customers. And I think that those situations, you know, made me start wondering, like, what do you do when you have these difficult behaviors, when they're a client or a customer or somebody where you don't have a, you know, a direct path, and you kind of are in a situation where, you know, you hear the customer is always right and things like that. And, you know, this could be in an engineering firm. It could be, like, in probably 1,000 different circumstances. So I appreciate you being on here with me today and am talking about this.
Absolutely, Kathy. So would you want to start off with a question, or should I just launch into what you just spoke of?
You know, just launch into what we just spoke of. And then I'm sure that I will have questions for you as we go, if that's all right.
You had said a phrase there that is often used, and that is the customer is always right. When you get into situations where you can get aggressive, if not abusive, behavior, we have to start questioning that mantra. I don't think we have to have a strong customer is always right philosophy that reigns all the time, especially if we get into behavior that is unacceptable. I can give you an example. Southwest Airlines is the poster child of an organizationally healthy company. Southwest Airlines lives according to their values. One of their values is humor. On a flight, when they were giving the FAA announcements, they did so with some humor. So about putting the mask on and having your seatbelt on and the trays up and all of this. One of the passengers took great exception to this and wrote to the CEO of Southwest Airlines admonishing him and his company for allowing safety to be trivialized and, you know, gamed kind of thing. And the CEO wrote back to the customer saying, "Dear whomever, we'll miss you." Signed, CEO, Southwest Airlines. So, you know, you don't have to abide by this understanding that the customer is always right. I just wanted to put that out there first. In terms of a lot of behavior that we see in workplaces, there has been this very strong tendency for the last number of years to, you know, just be nice to one another and to kind of sweep things under the carpet. I mean, you know, you have to, you know, you just have to suck things up and, you know, just get through this. The problem with not addressing interpersonal tensions is that the friction can build over time. And something that started out as a microaggression can become much stronger. And it will get to a point where you might even need mediation to be able to sort this stuff out. But if instead we don't get ourselves into this toxic positivity type mindset, and we realize that there is merit to saying to people what should be said, as opposed to telling them what they want to hear, we can diffuse a lot of these situations earlier than allowing them to build up to a point where, as I said, it can almost be, it can become insurmountable.
Let's maybe step back. So like when I first talked with you about, you know, coming on here and talking about microaggressions. So what are microaggressions and where do we delineate a microaggression from an aggression or a toxic behavior, or, you know, where's that delineation?
A lot of this is going to be quite dependent on people's perception, because perception is real to the perceiver. But in general, a microaggression might be something that a lot of people would say, oh, just brush that off. Mm-hmm. So it could be a word choice. It could be a tone of voice. It could be a phrase that was used. One of these types of examples that a lot of people would say, oh, don't sweat the small stuff kind of thing. So this has gotten a lot more attention since the Black Lives Matter movement. I'll give you an example. I have heard stories of very educated females, Black females in an academic setting, who have been in a conference where they have a break and people are just talking. And somebody says something, not necessarily hugely aggressive, but more along the lines of, oh, I didn't realize a Black woman would be here. Something like this. I don't think the person saying that meant to treat it as a dagger or anything, but she had heard this very personally, but so did a lot of other people. And that is where a lot of this Black Lives Matter movement talks about, you know, the difference between not racist and anti-racist. So not racist is not saying that phrase, oh, I'm surprised as a Black woman's even here. But anti-racist is actually confronting that person on behalf of the other person, of the Black woman. So if a female white colleague then went to the person who said that and said, I don't think that was an appropriate comment, that is being more anti-racist. That is attacking the microaggression at the core to make the person understand that what they said was not invited and not welcomed.
Okay, so I had someone say something to me at my company where it's just, you know, we're having getting ready for a client meeting and we're trying to figure out the roles of people that we were going to be meeting with. And this guy that I work with, there's a, you know, a woman, and I'm an engineer. I work in a very male dominated world. And he said, oh, well, maybe she's an admin. And I was like, yeah, that's not okay. And, you know, I didn't want to call him out at the meeting. So I think I called him after the meeting and said, you know, like as a female engineer, I don't think you should be assuming that just because it's a woman that they're an admin. And he was very apologetic. It was fine. I doubt that he will do it again. So, but I'm assuming that would be a microaggression.
Yes. Yes. And and a context will determine this all the time. And I think you made the way you described this, it was that it would have been extremely uncomfortable to call him out, so to speak, in front of his colleagues. But once you were able to get him on a one-on-one situation, you felt comfortable raising it. And that is totally fine. That is totally normal. The idea is to be able to get to the microaggressor, that their words, their behavior, whatever, affected you. And, you know, it wasn't something that you enjoyed feeling, and they need to know this because they were the cause of your discomfort.
How do you draw the line between, I had another work situation where, what I thought was microaggressions ended up, I think, being like more of aggressions, where there was yelling, there was people, somebody being very condescending. I felt it was more directed at the women on the team. But in my mind, initially, I was thinking these are microaggressions, but now I'm thinking they were just aggressions and creating, a toxic work environment. I got to the point that I was feeling sick to my stomach on Sundays because I didn't, this is my full-time project. And I was really, I got to the point that I was like job hunting because I'm like, I made a mistake going into the consulting world and stuff. And I'm like, I've been in the workforce for 28 years. I have no idea how to handle this. It got handled, but I feel like it was more of like a kind of a circumventing kind of a way versus me knowing how to deal with this. And I feel like at 50 years old and 28 years of experience, I should have a better handle on, how to handle these situations, whether it's someone that is, having toxic behavior or in a previous role where there was, I would say probably like more on the harassment side, but, just knowing how to handle these like nuanced situations where you don't have this direct line of being able to go to your company and report this behavior. Do you have suggestions on how to handle that?
So there was a lot in there. I'd like to start with first, give yourself a little bit of grace, mm-hmm. Kathy, because we live in a society that doesn't necessarily encourage difficult discussions. We're very much trained to just be available and to help other people and to not react to things. I don't think you're alone in this feeling that, you've been in the workplace for so long. How on earth is this happening now? But as you're recognizing, not saying anything is not making anything better. And when you say that you have a pit in your stomach on Sunday nights, that is a strong intuitive sign that something is desperately wrong. So I wouldn't fault you for anything that you described. But how to handle it is different. The earlier that these things can be handled, the better the outcome becomes. The more that you just thank God he didn't yell at me that time, the worse things will be. So it's important to recognize that if it's unacceptable behavior, it really does need to be addressed. But then we come down to what is unacceptable behavior. And I think a lot of people tend to believe that they know what is unacceptable behavior because of the way the person is behaving. That seems quite logical. But the problem with this is that we have a multitude of emotions and not as many ways to express those emotions. So I'll give you an example. And psychologists use this all the time. So if a psychologist is presented with a patient who is deathly afraid of something, of a public speech or, doing some type of activity, they're really, really afraid. So they tense up, their heart beats faster, they breathe quickly, they, all of the physiological reactions of fear. The psychologist reminds them that they can actually trick their brain to feed off of the physiological reaction, but see it as excitement, because excitement has the exact same profile as fear physiologically. So what they do is they tell the people before, this speech that you have to give or whatever it is that is causing them the fear, to get them to think that they are excited. Because if they can get their own brain to be feeding off of the physiological signals of fear, but interpret them as excitement, then they can walk into that activity with a much different mindset. So that's one example where the physiological manifestation maps to two different emotions. In the realm that we're talking, the physiological manifestation might be having a raised voice, having a strong tone, having maybe even a physical pounding the table kind of presence. Context is important, always. So one thing that can help in discerning what's going on is what words is the person using and how are they saying things? Because having that kind of physiological profile maps back to two different types of emotions. One is anger. And that's where, frankly, most of us go because we do have a negative bias that is built into us with our fight or flight kind of reaction. We often interpret that kind of physiological response as anger, but it could also be passion. It could also be that the person is just wrapped up in the subject and is very devoted to trying to express something. So it is important to not misdiagnose anger if it's passion, but assuming that you have diagnosed anger because one, it is directed at a person and it's not trying to flush out a subject, and two, you have used the word demeaning. So that would be probably reflected in the language that they're using and the way that they're expressing themselves that could be very hostily received by the person who is on the other end of that. And that is not something that should be tolerated. If somebody is in the throes of anger in a meeting, the person who called the meeting should stop the meeting and invite that person outside in the hallway and talk to them about what just happened and describe to them how that behavior is not acceptable. And are they able to engage in acceptable behavior at that meeting, giving the person a choice?
What if the person who called the meeting is the one who is exhibiting that behavior?
So then it gets a little bit more challenging. Yes. So if the person, like your boss kind of a thing, is the person who is exhibiting that behavior, it takes incredible strength of character to be able to stand up to that. It still should be done, but I don't think, because the psychological safety might have been broken to such a point with that kind of leadership, it's going to be awfully difficult to have an employee, somebody who reports to that person, to be able to do the exact same thing. Put a timeout on the meeting, everybody take a break. Okay, we're going to go into the hallway and we're going to talk about what just happened. But you might still have somebody who is able to do that. And that is, of course, the best thing possible, because a lot of people might not even know the effect that they're having on others with the behavior that they're displaying. If they've never been told, then it's possible that they just think that this is the way you do this.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is, because we live in a culture that tends, look at the movies that are popular, you know, they tend to really accentuate behaviors that we don't want to see. And if that is what we recognize as good leadership in our society, then it's not surprising that a lot of people are displaying that kind of behavior. But we do need to be able to let people know that this macho type of behavior is a Hollywood ploy, and it's not actually dealing with real people. And real people need to be treated as real people, with feelings and with responses and emotions.
So I would say, you know, like when I've had situations like this in the past within my company, and I had a situation like this with my manager, I would, you know, go in and talk to this person directly one-on-one, very similar to how I dealt with that other comment. And I felt pretty comfortable doing that, even if, you know, even with my manager. But when it came to being on the client side, I was really perplexed. And again, I haven't been a consultant. It's been less than a year. And there's kind of two things here. I know I kind of like dump things on you. Like I kind of like do a brain dump and like let you sort it out. You know, so there's the piece of being on the client side, and then there's, you know, when you talk about it within, you know, your group setting within, you know, like my company team, it's like, oh, well, so-and-so is just like that. Or, you know, there'll be other people that'll say like, you need to have thicker skin, you quit being so sensitive. All these different kinds of things of like almost feeling like, well, am I making too big of a deal out of it? Am I right. the one who has the problem and everyone else is, you know, they're fine tolerating and they don't understand, you know, they don't see this as being, you know, toxic behavior where I'm like, oh my God, like, I don't want to go to work and I need to start looking for another job. But, you know, like, is there something wrong with me? It's kind of how you start like thinking about this in your head. Do you have any thoughts on that? And then again, how to handle it when it's not somebody within your company who is displaying that behavior?
So again, you're going to have to forgive yourself a little bit. If you have strong instinctual gut reactions to this whole situation, I think there's a reason you're having them. If people are telling you to grow a thicker skin and, you know, don't sweat the small stuff, this kind of thing, that's just the way he is. That narrative has got to change. It is not acceptable to belittle other people. We need to put human dignity a lot higher than we have been doing for many, many years. If people actually count, then they're going to be treated as people and not just dispensable, you know, consultants or whomever, whatever the role is. I can agree that it is difficult when you are faced with the situation that you've described, because you feel alone. And that is probably the most terrifying feeling you can have. I mean, this whole pandemic has brought that to the forefront for a lot of people. Feeling alone is something most people are not very comfortable with, especially if you believe that everybody else is of one mindset and you're of a different mindset. That can be very, very threatening, especially if you're on the receiving end of a lot of abusive type behavior or language. Maybe in this kind of situation, you might want to defer to some of the things that you started this conversation with, Kathy, and in the official policies, the people who negotiated the contract in the first place, people who might not be around some of the behavior that you are experiencing and whom you can use as allies to be able to not feel quite so alone and make it known that this kind of behavior is just not acceptable at the workplace.
Okay, so this would be a situation where I don't, in my role, I don't necessarily address it directly with that person, which is what I did. And, you know, it got handled through conversations that I had with other people who were in roles that they could address it. Because I guess in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, I should be able to handle this directly at the state that I am in my career. But you're saying that in my role, that's probably the best way to go is going through like an escalation within my company so it can go over to the people who can deal with it appropriately within their relationships with the client.
It's very context dependent, Kathy. So a lot of this is best dealt with at an interpersonal level. There's huge merit, as I was saying earlier, to address these things much earlier than most people do. Yeah. Just to go back to Southwest Airlines, they have a practice called come to Jesus moments, where if they feel like as a company, they're trained in this. If they feel an interpersonal conflict coming on and they're trained on how to recognize this, I mean, we all know what it is, because aviation has crashed planes over this kind of thing. It's important to not let that get out of hand. So they are very much encouraged to call a come to Jesus moment when they feel as though there should be one and they have it out. And it, you know, it might only be 3 minutes to be able to maybe just clarify a miscommunication or something, but they get it out early. they stomp it out early so that you don't have these, you know, mediated conversations that need to go through, you know, formal processes.
So part of the reason I keep going back to this is because I work with a lot of younger people and I'm like, okay, if I don't know how to deal with this, I'm guessing that they probably don't either. So I guess in my mind, it's developing a toolbox, right? For how to handle yes. different situations and being given the right tools so that you know how to address different situations. So what you're saying is you might have tools that you use early on in a situation. And one of those tools might be to talk to that person directly, depending on what the situation is, what the context is. And then you might also have different tools where you do need to escalate and you do need to go through a different process if those things aren't getting, I guess, the corrective action that you're looking for. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I think so. I mean, the only reason that things would need to go through a formal process is because they weren't addressed at the early stages, because they've been allowed to fester and things are just not at a comfortable level anymore. Because often when things begin, unless somebody comes out of the gate swearing and belittling and everything, and is just not somebody who you can approach at any time, it is almost impossible to start there. You know, it is almost certainly that there would have been some opportunity earlier on when things are safer, when you have the ability to talk to this person as a person, expressing what you said was actually hurtful to me. And I just wanted to let you know that, because I don't think you should be saying things like that. You know, just letting them know how you were affected.
So I know you have a technical background as well, like earlier in your career. A lot of people that are in STEM fields, and this is generalizing, so I'm going, like a lot, are introverted, right? And a lot of us avoid confrontation and things like that, which is, you know, I think can then lead to things festering and not being dealt with as early as they could be dealt with. Do you have any advice for how to, I guess, get up the courage to have those difficult conversations to address them earlier on before they become a bigger issue?
To address your question about STEM being full of introverts, you might be right. There might be a reluctance for introverts to, you know, engage in things like this because they have to engage in difficult conversations. But I don't know if extroverts are that much better at it either. So I just want to put that on the record. Difficult conversations are difficult conversations for a reason, because, you know, people are not wanting to do this. It's so much easier just to let it go and just to, you know, pretend it didn't happen.
Sweep it under the rug. Yeah, exactly. Hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, and pray that, yeah, it doesn't happen again. Because it is hard work to be able to address these difficult conversations. Pat Lencioni talks about how this is the role of leaders. They need to engage in difficult conversations. They should be doing that more than anything else. And most leaders, I suspect, don't. They see their job as more technically oriented, especially if they come from a technical field, you know, sorting out the contracts and getting more money and all this kind of thing, strategy and so forth. He argues that true leadership is developing people mm-hmm. first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And in that, difficult conversations are part of the toolkit. And, you know, it's the best gift that you can give to somebody is to tell them something about their behavior that is being disruptive to others, being hurtful perhaps to others, that they don't even know they're doing.
What if they do it on purpose? Like, is that a thing? I mean, are there people that just think it's okay to be mean and that's the way that, and you kind of said this because that's what people see in the movies.
I think there is a societal portrayal that is feeding into this. I'm not sure how many people, I mean, some people are I think like to see the reaction of other people. They like to engage in the drama of things. But at the core of it, if you actually get them to communicate on a, you know, a human one-on-one level, I'm not sure there are too many people. There are some too many people who actually enjoy causing suffering to others. I mean, if there are people who enjoy causing suffering to others as their main purpose to work, that is a more serious problem. And that, you know, that will, you will need more help than just a one-on-one difficult conversation.
So let's talk about this toolkit. You know, in my mind, like, this is irregardless of whether you're female, what your race is. Bad behavior can happen to anyone, right?
Absolutely.
What kind of tools should we have, and how should we be equipping, in my mind, I'm thinking younger people, but it's really anybody, to have the right tools to handle these situations? And what are those tools?
Okay, well, let's start being introspective first. So you had said correctly that these situations can arise anywhere. They happen in families, they happen in workplaces, they happen in volunteer committees, they happen in you know, in all social situations. If we have been the cause of an untoward comment, which we all are at some point or another, we need to start using the words, "I'm sorry. I hadn't realized what I said would offend you. I apologize for my behavior." So that is going to be one set of tools. If we are aware, self-aware enough to realize that we might be engaging in that kind of behavior. People are willing to receive apologies when they are genuine. I'd offer that as the first set of tools. So if we're talking about the other set of tools, we might take the first understanding that the person didn't realize the impact of what they were doing. And so this is going to be a genuine letting them know something about themselves that they might not have known. There's a construct called the Johari window that can be very, very helpful in this, that allows you to identify things about yourself that you know and you portray to the world, things about yourself that you know and you do not want to portray to the world. These are your deep, dark secrets that you share with very few people, if anyone. Then there are things that the world knows about you and you don't know. And then there are things that the world doesn't know about you and you don't know. So these are, you know, very sub, you know, subconscious type understandings that often need therapy to get at. But if we talk about things that the world know about you and you don't know, that is a helpful framework with which to approach these type of conversations. You can start from there, that they are exhibiting behavior that everybody sees, but they don't know is being interpreted the way, you know, is being taken by everybody else. And that will give you more compassion. You'll be approaching this from a more compassionate place than a very, you know, assertive and aggressive place, confrontation place. Yes.
Interesting. I honestly had not thought about that. And that's very, it's very interesting. And insightful. Like I appreciate that context.
You can just Google Johari window. It's not that, it's not that foreign, but you're right. A lot of STEM doesn't teach this, but I had heard that a team that had engaged in using the Johari window had come up with playful names for that particular quadrant of the world sees, but you don't know. And so they came up with fun little names like Dr. Bebop, so bubble popper. So if a particular leader or person on a team tends to just bring the team down all the time. Even though the team is excited about a small win or something, they will just suck the air out of the room. And so then the team is now equipped with this, hey, Dr. Bebop, don't be popping bubbles here, because they had that conversation. And they are aware of what this means. You know, it's almost having this coded language so that this team can ensure when somebody engages in this type of behavior, it is going to be a lot safer to call it out because they put playful names to it.
I really like that. And I think even just being aware, like, you know, changing the mindset from like thinking of it from they may not be aware. And so your conversation is like, it feels like a much lighter conversation then.
Absolutely. And I mean, it depends on when this conversations take place. If a conversation, as I said, takes place decades after the behavior was first acknowledged and nothing was said and things have been allowed to fester for a very long time, it's going to be that much more difficult. Whereas at the beginning of a relationship, work or otherwise, if these types of conversations can take place, as you had correctly mentioned, it does seem much lighter because you don't have as much invested in the relationship in all sorts of other ways.
So it's really having the conversation early when you start noticing the behavior. Like, I guess in my mind, you know, like it happens once, you let it go. Happens twice, maybe that's when you start having that conversation.
Again, the context is going to drive this. If that once is in a high stakes environment and you were humiliated in front of a whole bunch, you know, your colleagues, maybe that's not the right kind of filter to put it through.
True.
So context is going to drive this almost exclusively.
Okay. Okay. Are there other tools that would be good for people to have in their toolkit?
Making sure that you can have a network around you so that instead of feeling alone, that you do have others who you can go to, and you will help them when they are in a similar situation. So investing in a trusted network that you will hold each other accountable, kind of thing, and that you will come to each other's help when called upon, I think might be another tool that you could work with. That I think a lot of women, I think, inherently have this in the way that they establish their friend groups, but maybe not so much on holding each other accountable the way that I was just talking about with the Johari window. Because if you feel as though you're alone, you tend to regress and just crawl into a fetal ball and hope the world goes away. That is not helpful. We have to start dealing with the world as it is, not the world that we want it to be. Being alone, we are social animals. We need to make sure that we keep connections that enrich us.
With the network that you're building, in my mind, my network is large, right? There are people in my network that are within my company, outside my company, inside my country, outside my country. Like, but I also think that in these particular situations, like, you also might want to make sure that you have a good internal network within your company, because some of them are so company specific or situation specific that other people can't necessarily understand and help you deal with them. So it feels like both networks are very important.
Absolutely. Like, and I mean, again, if this is happening in, you know, a non-work context, then maybe you need a non-work network. So it is the circumstances and the context is going to determine how this works, but you should probably have a core network that you hold very close to you. You've talked about a whole bunch of networks that a lot of us have, but we might not be rallying behind people in all circumstances. Mm-hmm. These might be looser connections. So the core network is going to be not necessarily many people. Maybe it's just one person, but they're honestly there for you when you need them and you are there for them. That network is going to at least give you the feeling that you're not alone.
Okay, so are there any other tools?
there's probably a myriad of tools, but the main idea here is to try to establish trust early on. And vulnerability-based trust is not something that we tend to use a lot in a lot of our in a lot of our organizations. Again, the society in which we are bathed does not value this stuff, or at least it hasn't. But we're getting, I think, to a point where we are starting to reward. Timothy Clark from Leader Factor talks about psychological safety being an environment that rewards vulnerability. If we can start to be more vulnerable in our interactions, knowing a bit about people, not just the transactional relationship that we have in the office. So knowing a bit about their lives, their hopes and dreams, their struggles and fears, and this kind of thing. If we can start to be more vulnerable at work and start to relate to each other as people, that might be yet another tool that can be used, because that will establish trust. And once you have trust established, then you can start working on all sorts of other things that are important. The five dysfunctions of a team, as espoused by Pat Lencioni, trust is the basis, this vulnerability-based trust, where you do use the words, I'm sorry, and you're better at this than I am, and all of this kind of language, which we don't hear a whole lot. Humility is really, really important in this kind of approach.
How can leaders within companies support employees when they come to them with these difficult work situations? Like, what would I do as a leader, as if I'm going to be a good leader, a good supportive leader, when somebody comes to me with a situation, you know, like I've been talking about?
First off, to listen. Spend as much time listening as you can. A lot of leaders are expected to be the know-it-alls and to come and, you know, be the hero to solve everything. But a lot of leadership, genuine leadership, is listening. And you would be listening for how the person coming to you is feeling and how they are dealing with this. Again, a lot of leadership is trying to develop people. So it might be just a conversation like we're having and giving the person the tools to be able to deal with the situation, instead of coming down and paternalizingly taking care of it all. That might be my suggestion on that. It depends, again, on how serious things have gotten. So if we have gotten to outright harassment and things, then absolutely there's going to be a different approach. But if we're still at the early stages of interpersonal conflict, the leader helping the person gain the confidence to deal with this themselves is going to be the best place for the leader.
Okay, so it sounds to me like in my particular situation is that I should have addressed it early, both from a standpoint of on my own with directly with the person, regardless of whether they're a client, a customer, a coworker, whoever, and also start having some of those conversations with leadership within my company to help guide me and develop those tools for making sure I'm having those conversations, and also to just, I would say, almost to provide part of that network and support for being able to make sure it's getting handled, but handling it early on as opposed to letting it fester.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we can't fix everything, but we can certainly take control of our present and of what's going to happen. While we may not, you know, as you had said, like there are things that have already happened. Okay, so there might be a situation there that has to be handled a little differently than the ones going forward, because you are able to now talk about some of these things that, to be fair, technically oriented organizations do not talk about these things very much, and start to have these conversations.
Do you have any like closing comments or other, you know, anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation?
I think that a lot of what we've talked about isn't talked about enough, especially in highly technical organizations. So I thank you for having this discussion, Kathy. I think it's a very needed discussion. And two, I think that a lot of these behaviors, a lot of this change in orientation is going to be difficult for a lot of people. So they have to start practicing, because practice is going to make you more comfortable with it. Start having these conversations in low risk settings, so that you can become more accustomed to the language and to the mindset and to the orientation that you have to have when the risks get a little bit higher.
So almost like role playing.
Almost like role playing, so that you can get familiar with the way that you're thinking and the words that you're using, so that when you need to call on this, you will be more confident in it, because it's not going to be your first time doing it.
Yeah, I think that's great. Before we close, do you maybe just want to like walk me through your organization? So beyond safety compliance and like what you do and what you specialize in, because I think it's really interesting, and you have a very highly technical background before this. And so I'm just kind of, I would just like to hear what your company does and give you an opportunity to talk about it and the work that you do.
So you're right, Kathy. I do have a technical background. I have 2 degrees in physics, but my orientation is such that I am a lifelong learner. And I went to a lot of talks, chiefly in the air traffic control aviation type fields, because that was the network that I was in at the time. And I noticed that people were far more comfortable talking about lasers and gauges and where the lever was, and shied away from the topics of organizations and where people were involved. And I found that fascinating. So for years, I noticed that there is a huge discomfort with a lot of these technical people talking about the people dynamics. So I went and got a PhD in more of these people dynamics kinds of things. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm trying to bring to a lot of organizations the kind of approach that we've had in this discussion.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think it's so interesting, because I don't know many technical people who have gone that route. And it seems really interesting to me. And honestly, not something that I've thought a ton about until it's when I've been, trying to like really deal with this very difficult situation that I've encountered. Honestly, something I might look into a little bit more, because I think it's fascinating.
People are endlessly fascinating. When I had recognized that there's going to be a limit, even though we're getting into all sorts of technical advances in our world, there's a limit to technology always. And there is so much more we can do on the people side. And we're going to be able to get so much advantage by focusing on the people side a little bit more than we have been. I mean, production is going to increase, because if you have people who, my main mantra is to have people enjoy their work. It's possible, but it's going to be possible only once these types of conversations that we've had on this call are had more often.
Yeah. Well, Tanya, I really appreciate you being on the podcast and having this conversation with me. I'm hoping that it's helpful for any of my listeners that are out there, because, I think we all deal with difficult work situations at one time or another. And I think knowing how to approach it and what tools to have in our toolbox is really, really important. So thank you so very much.
You're very welcome, Kathy. And actually, I have a monthly webinar, which is free. You can connect with me on LinkedIn, and my company page is Beyond Safety Compliance. There's this webinar is the third Wednesday of the month, and it's from 11 to 12:15 Eastern Daylight Time right now, Eastern Time. And we're going to be talking about different aspects of work through this series. So I'd invite your listeners to connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Tanya Hewitt, and from Beyond Safety Compliance and to sign up for these webinars, because we might be able to get more people aware of some of these concepts much faster if we start talking about them.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, conversations are really the most important thing that we can do. I will also have a link to that in my episode notes too, so that people can find you and find your webinar. So thank you for mentioning that.
Wonderful.
All right. Thank you so much, Tanya.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. You can find a list of definitions, acronyms, and a fact check in the episode notes. If you like this podcast, please like it and write a review. And if you'd like to have more episodes delivered right to you, please feel free to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.